Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Ian Kramer, executive director of the Leaders Engaged on Alzheimer's Disease, or LEAD, Coalition, to discuss some relevant topics within the AD field, including the discontinuation of aducanumab. Kramer, a community leader who is not a clinician, spoke on the drug development and communication with patients with Alzheimer's disease, as well as the potential and limitations with novel therapies like lecanemab. Furthermore, he discussed the approval process of AD therapies and how the community can continue to be productive going forward. Let's dive in.
Us at the LEAD Coalition, everything is an opportunity. You know, we certainly are aware that there are a lot of challenges in the landscape, but we see tremendous openings to do better. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. So we all know that lecanemab, Leqembi, as its brand name is already on the market, has been for about 6 months. There's been some uptake, but we understand there are a lot of bottlenecks in the healthcare system that are slowing down access. Demand seems to be fairly strong, and I think will continue to grow. But we have to make sure that for patients who would like to pursue this, would like to get a workup to see if they're eligible for this therapy and work with their clinician, we have to make sure they can get to a qualified clinician, that clinician has system capacity within his or her practice, can get access to PET scanning, or is able to have a productive conversation about CSF testing as an alternative, that as a policy coalition, we do what we can to make sure that that appropriate biomarker tests are developed and then become available to clinicians so that their array of options to open up some of those bottlenecks becomes stronger. And then also that the reimbursement is there, so that it's not just there is a PET scanner and there's tracer available and the clinician knows how to order it, but that the clinician and his or her institution have confidence that the regional Medicare administrative contractors are going to reimburse in a clear and timely manner. So for us, you can say, well, those are all problems. We look at it as, you know, we've got the door a bit open. Now we just need to work collaboratively with the clinical community, with policymakers, with public and private payers to open up those bottlenecks. And again, right patient, right treatment, right time. We're certainly never going to advocate that clinicians use a therapy or a diagnostic or a non-pharmacological intervention that they aren't comfortable with or that their patients aren't comfortable with, or that wouldn't meet their needs. But where there's that match, we need to get the barriers out of the way and create opportunities for improved quality of life.
You know, obviously it's been known that there's been some inconsistencies with the drug development per se. Obviously with the discontinuation of aducanumab was certainly a mark, but also there's just been a lot of sort of controversy within the field about, you know, drugs working, when they don't work, who they work on, when they work, what patients they're working on. So how do we sort of improve the efficiencies of drug development from both a policy and a constructive standpoint?
Right. And there are a lot of constructive things we can do, and we can start anywhere. but let's start at the very, very beginning. I think the most important thing that both academic researchers as well as pharmaceutical companies that are trying to develop new products, again, whether those are disease-modifying or symptomatic agents in Alzheimer's or any other form of dementia or outside of dementia entirely, oncology, hematology, anything, we should always start by finding out what matters and what matters most to people that are at risk for these disorders and then live with these disorders. If we're aiming at the wrong targets for a therapy or an intervention, well, you know, we've started at the wrong place, we're going to end at the wrong place. But what we have found consistently through patient-focused, person-centered research, and I can give you some references if you like, there's a terrific set of studies called the What Matters Most studies conducted by RTI International, what that's finding both qualitatively and quantitatively is that there are an array of sub-issues that matter to people at risk for or living with Alzheimer's disease specifically. And those include some obvious things like memory and cognition. But a lot of the other, and I think there were 42 items that all rated as very, very important. A lot of them, I'm going to be oversimplistic here, but it can be reduced to not wanting to feel dependent on others or like you're a burden on others. And intuitively, you know, that makes sense to all of us, whether we have clinical training or like me, no clinical training. None of us want to feel like we're imposing on anyone else, but we also want to feel that we can be reasonably self-sufficient for as long as possible in as many domains that roll up into quality of life as possible. So if we're aiming at the right drug target, and we've got that evidence base to know that we're aiming at the right effect for a drug, and that those targets are assessed in a representative way, that the cohorts of people that were asked what their preferences and needs are or would be, well, then we have to make sure that the trials to develop the medical interventions are equally representative. And again, I promise I'll take a breath after this. We know that lack of representativeness in drug trials, as well as device trials and medical procedure trials, that's not limited to one disease or one intervention. That's across the biomedical system. And it's partly because we haven't tried hard enough and partly because we haven't worked smart enough. But it's also, I hope it's not a cop-out to say that we should all be mindful of the fact that 400 years of institutional and systemic discrimination around race and ethnicity principally, but not only, that's not done and over and gone. It's not just that there are sort of vestigial effects of it. It's that it's a present living reality for many people from medically underserved communities. And is it any wonder, not just with that history, but with that current present lived experience, that across disease states, we're not doing as good a job as we would all like to. And as much as we're trying, we have to find new ways to do better to get more representative cohorts so that everybody, regulators, payers, clinicians, and most important, patients and their families can have a greater degree of confidence that they are the right patient for the right drug at the right time. So there are no magic bullets, but progress is being made. Donanemab has improved over what aducanumab had in its studies. Lecanemab was certainly stronger than aducanumab's studies. And I hope whatever comes next is going to be stronger yet, but hope isn't going to be enough. We're going to have to fix a lot of what's broken in the system of clinical trial design and recruitment before we can hold anyone to account for needing to do better.
Ian, I know we've kind of mentioned a little bit about aducanumab, which obviously we have to talk about aducanumab. So, you know, obviously it was discontinued a couple of weeks ago, and that kind of, I guess, per se, closes the books on what aducanumab was for a couple of years. So talk a little bit about what the discontinuation of aducanumab means for the community and just what your general thoughts were on the news.
So you're right. That door has closed. For better or worse, scientific debates aside, patients who have been on MF, either in a clinical trial, the open label, or for other reasons, have a concrete conversation with them about what their options may be. If they're still at a stage of disease where they are eligible for lecanemab, learn what you need to about lecanemab to have it. The two drugs are not identical. They both monoclonal antibodies. They both attack accumulation in the brain. They do it in slightly different ways, and they have slightly different risk-benefit propositions. And at least for now, while the means of administration for both would be infusion, both may be moving towards subcutaneous injection in the future. No promises made from me, but that also will be part of the conversation, what the prospects are. And then, as you're probably aware and your audience is aware, donanemab looks like it may be something that a patient can be on for about a year and then potentially come off of. And so that's a complex discussion to have, but isn't it great that clinicians can have these rich, complicated discussions and have multiple options potentially with progress in the future for even easier administration, maybe shorter course of treatment, and maybe clearer results and lower exposure to any potential adverse events. And we couldn't have any of those conversations with aducanumab for a lot of including using to cover it. So we're in a much better place now, and aducanumab helped open that door. And you know, I'm personally, some of his family has been affected by dementia a number of times. I'm thrilled that we're at a point now where we can start having conversations about hope and opportunity for a bright future. Drugs are not a cure. No first generation meds ever are for any disease. We now see there's light at the end of the tunnel.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Ian to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on April 10th, Brainstorm Cell Therapeutics announced that the FDA agreed to a new trial design for a Phase 3b study using a special protocol assessment to assess its investigational ALS product Neuron. The Phase 3b trial, expected to commence in 2024, is a two-part multi-center study of 200 patients with ALS that is supposed to support a future biologics license application for the agent. The following day, on April 11th, the FDA approved two new administration options for SK Life Sciences anti-seizure medication cenobamate for adults with partial onset seizures. The treatment tablets can now be crushed or mixed with water and either administered by mouth or as an oral suspension or via a nasogastric tube, providing additional flexibility for dosing. The label update was supported by findings from an open-label, randomized, three-period, six-sequence, balanced crossover study that assessed three cenobamate administration routes in 24 healthy participants. And finally, at the 2024 American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, new data from the Phase 3 RISE-PD trial assessing IPX203, an oral formulation of carbidopa-levodopa extended-release capsules, revealed an association between longer exposure to IPX203 and a decrease in the occurrence of treatment-emergent adverse events. These findings demonstrated the safety and tolerability of IPX across various dosage ranges, even at the highest dosage, over an extended period of use. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Ian.
It's been awesome that we at least are having these conversations, that we have options available for patients. And you know, it's definitely better than what it was 10, 15 years ago, where those conversations weren't even happening per se. So I'm just curious, last couple of thoughts on aducanumab. What are some of the biggest lessons that we've learned from aducanumab and just the whole process of it just in general? What are some of the biggest lessons and takeaways that we have?
You know, there may be some lessons from aducanumab, but frankly, I think there are more important lessons from lecanemab and donanemab. For better or worse, sorry, let me phrase this differently. And I'm not trying to be, you know, more politically correct about anything, just collecting my thoughts for a moment, you know, because this has been a very difficult but very exciting last few years. And passions have been very high on all sides. And I think for the right reasons. We all want to find the right answers for as many people as possible facing dementia. But One of the most important lessons that we can take from the aducanumab experience is that headlines should not drive policy decisions. And you know, I can't give you a metric and tell you to what degree it did, but there were a lot of deeply, deeply misleading headlines across media. And I know journalists do their level best and they're expected to become instant experts in a new topic from day to day. I would never want their job. I could never do their job. They do yeoman's work, but they don't always do it perfectly. And there were misleading headlines for and against aducanumab, but it didn't make anyone's life easier as a clinician, as a prospective patient, as a regulator, as a payer, as a policymaker, as a researcher. I think there was a less than perfect discussion around lecanemab. There's been a less than perfect discussion around donanemab, but I don't think those discussions have been as fraught. And I trace some of this back, not maybe all of it, but some of it back to the remarkably unusual drug development journey that aducanumab was on. And, you know, again, I'm a relative layperson in this. I've been doing dementia policy for 27 plus years, but I'm not a scientist and I'm not a clinician. What I can tell you is that it was sort of a one in a million situation, the journey that aducanumab went through. You know, there was a futility analysis. And whether you like Biogen or you don't like Biogen as a company, that's up to you. What I can tell you is they did absolutely the right and necessary thing in listening to that futility analysis and stopping the study. And then they did absolutely the right thing in listening to the readout of the evidence that came in after the futility analysis, talking with the FDA, and on the FDA's, I think, sound advice, trying to restart the study so that that all that effort, not by Biogen, but by the people that were in those studies as trial volunteers, so that that effort wouldn't be wasted. They produced the results that they were capable of under that remarkably unusual journey. And they did what they're supposed to do and take the evidence to the FDA. And frankly, I think FDA made the right decision for an accelerated approval. It wasn't the question that was originally being asked of the advisory panel, but that's okay. Advisory panels are advisory. FDA has world-class neurologists, and among those world-class neurologists, world-class Alzheimer's expert neurologists. And they looked at the totality of the evidence and they said, we've got enough for this to go to market under really clear guidance from FDA about appropriate use, but we're going to want more evidence. And the shame of it all is we aren't getting the opportunity to develop that evidence. And again, whether you like Biogen or you don't like Biogen is frankly irrelevant. The reason we aren't going to get the chance to develop the evidence is because of CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, using a tool for which there is at least a healthy debate about whether they actually have authority, this thing called coverage with evidence development. It's clear CMS has authority to cover drugs or decline to cover drugs. This sort of squishy in-between where CMS requires studies that look a whole lot like FDA required studies, but aren't under FDA's authority. That's, again, I'll use the technical term squishy. That's kind of squishy. But what we know happened is they made it an impossible real world experience to run those studies, particularly in an environment where, again, as CMS understood was going to be the case, there were other drugs in the pipeline that were going to go for traditional approval. And as it turned out, one has already gotten traditional approval and another is on the cusp of getting it. In that environment, there was going to be no way to run the additional clinical studies on aducanumab. And I'll just put it bluntly, at least as a logical proposition, and clinicians can tell me that's not how they operate, but as a layperson, that's how I think they operate. If they've got a fully traditionally approved FDA treatment available, and another one that's only approved under accelerated approval, and to get on that drug, you have to have a placebo arm to the study. So you have to put people on a placebo in lieu of either the accelerated approved product or the traditionally approved product. What clinician is going to recommend that their patient go into that clinical study? They're going to tell them, go on lecanemab, or only go on aducanumab outside the context of a study where you know you're getting the drug if you're prepared for the risk and the benefit. So it was an untenable proposition. And this is my long way around of saying that we have to do at least three things, not just in neurology, not just in Alzheimer's, but in medical innovation generally. We have to stand up for the integrity of accelerated approval that didn't come about in the last few years to the benefit of one company or one disease state. Came about 30 years ago to save a generation of people facing HIV/AIDS. And since then, it has saved countless people facing other diseases, including cancer. It's only the most recent example of its use in Alzheimer's, where everything seemed to swirl in controversy. But CMS institutionally needs to respect the existence of accelerated approval, and FDA needs to remain confident that if it issues an accelerated approval, that that will mean coverage by CMS for those products, or otherwise it's a futile exercise for FDA to even have accelerated approval. And we can throw away progress for generations of people across disease spectrums, not just for people with Alzheimer's. So we need to stand up for that. And we also need to help journalists write better stories, more grounded in the science, with a deeper appreciation of the science. And we need to stop blaming the writers of those stories for the headlines written by someone else in that office. We need to make sure those headline writers get it right too.
Ian, I have one last question for you, and I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. The one last question is what we're talking about right now. Obviously, these therapies are not curative, but they can have very, very substantial effects on the right patient, depending on who it may be. So, you know, are there ways in which we can better communicate about the potential and as well as the limitations of these novel emerging therapies? Just talk a little bit about, from a patient-clinician relationship conversation perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, again, as a non-clinician, I try to be a little cautious about lecturing, not just clinicians, but neurologists and Alzheimer's specialists within neurology specifically. But, you know, I'll throw a little caution to the wind and say that we need to have life course conversations about brain health with patients. And remember that they are whole human beings. And I don't know too many clinicians that forget that, but in the pressure of an office visit, I know there's a lot to get done. And reimbursement has not caught up with the necessity of having life course conversations about diseases that can develop over a life course and are multifactorial. But you know, the easiest way, and it won't be easy, but the easiest way to get to a more perfect world is to start behaving like we are in a more perfect world and force the system to catch up to that demand and that emerging reality. So without being too Pollyannish, here's what I would suggest, maybe more to primary care physicians, specialists, but in a collaborative spirit with specialists who can help inform primary care physicians and maybe help facilitate and deliver them the payoff to the primary care physicians for doing this better. You know, we already are getting better about having conversations with young patients and their families about the risks of head injury, hitting a soccer ball or tackle football or other things. We're not banning those sports, but we're trying to be smarter about how we play them, how we coach them, how we officiate them, and how we equip them. We can and should do similar things relating a lot of conditions to the potential impacts on later life brain health, whether that's Alzheimer's disease or other conditions. So we should be talking about avoiding smoking or smoking cessation, not only in the context of lung cancer, but also in terms of brain health. We should talk about diabetes prevention and mitigation and recovery, to the extent that becomes more and more possible, not only in the context of not losing your vision and your limbs, but also reducing your chances for dementia as that evidence gets stronger and stronger. It's not definitive as a causal factor yet, but it's looking like that's where we're heading. But you can also have that conversation, again, in an appropriately direct but supportive way, and say what I will say more bluntly, which is, if you get dementia, it's better to have it without diabetes than with diabetes, in part because it's easier to live a good quality of life with dementia if you have your vision and your limbs. So, you know, don't be that blunt and that crass with your patients, but convey that important message that if, God forbid, and medicine forbid, you wind up with Alzheimer's disease or any other cause of dementia, better that you not be a smoker, better that you not be hypertensive, better that you not be diabetic, better that you not have untreated hearing loss or vision loss, better that you not be depressed and socially isolated, better that you have more education rather than less, and on down the list. And there are a lot of proactive life course health strategies that primary care doctors can inform and support with the alliance of a variety of specialists to give people a better chance of not having dementia, or of having a slower progression of dementia, or have a less intense experience with dementia because their other elements of health have been better and hopefully remain better. And that's irrespective of where we are with drug interventions. The therapeutics, the drug therapies, can only make a good situation better or a bad situation somewhat less bad. So let's do everything we can earlier and right up until dementia and then through the course of dementia. I'll just give you one more example. One more example, I promise, unless you want five. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has something called the Innovation Center, created under the Affordable Care Act. It's called CMMI for short. CMMI has just launched something called the Guide Model. The application period closed at the end of January for healthcare providers to apply to be part of this model. And boiled way, way down, what this model will do is compensate healthcare providers that are enrolled in this project to deliver euphemistically what could be called comprehensive dementia care services. It's not truly comprehensive, but it's a heck of a lot better than the completely fragmented, you're on your own kind of status quo that most people with dementia experience outside of their direct clinical care for the dementia itself. So among other things, there's an allowance of up to $2,500 per person, per Medicare beneficiary that's served under this model through a qualified provider, $2,500 a year for respite services. That can be checking into an assisted living facility for a few days so the family member gets a break, or it can be a whole lot of in-home health support, or it can be a whole lot of community-based adult day center support. And $2,500 is not enough, but it's $2,500 more than a lot of these families have. It's also going to provide, and docs up and down the line are going to get this one, a care navigator. So the doctor's office and its ancillary staff aren't going to have as many missed appointments by those patients and aren't going to be asked to connect those patients to social services and arrange their transportation and do all those other things that clinicians are neither trained nor compensated to provide, except now through the Guide Model. And isn't that a glorious thing? So one of the things that clinicians will be able to do if they're in the Guide Model is do more for their patients without more burden on themselves and actually reducing the burden on their practices. And one of the things that clinicians will be able to do with this kind of greater support is feel more comfortable making a diagnosis, conveying a diagnosis, and then having a conversation about whether, in addition to these social service supports, maybe it's time to have a conversation about an available therapy to help with not only the disease progression, in this case, lecanemab, maybe soon donanemab, but also to better manage the symptoms. And that's not just the old school meds that have been around for 20 years or more in some cases. It's also brand new medications. And many of your audience will know about this development, but many other healthcare providers won't. Brexpiprazole, Rexulti is the name brand, has been on market for a long time for other things than dementia, but it has now received an FDA approval for Alzheimer's disease, dementia, agitation. And as your audience knows, untreated or under-supported symptoms of agitation can be drivers of failure of family caregiving and the need for otherwise premature institutionalization of a person with Alzheimer's disease dementia. So trust me when I say, brexpiprazole or Rexulti is not the first option, and for some individuals, it's not the right option. All the non-pharmacological interventions for agitation should be tried first. We know that they work for a lot of people, in many cases, for the rest of their lives. We also know that for a subset of people that are experiencing Alzheimer's disease, dementia, agitation, all the non-pharmacological interventions in the world applied thoroughly and empathetically and lovingly won't work or won't work sufficiently. And isn't it a wonder that now clinicians have an option for an on-label, fully FDA-approved treatment that they can discuss with patients and families to try? And, you know, nobody can guarantee any results, particularly in something as complicated as dementia-related agitation. And again, in this case, the drug is only approved for the Alzheimer's form of agitation. But it can be a lifesaver, a literal lifesaver, not just for people experiencing the agitation, but also for their loved ones. I think we all know people, loving, compassionate, talented, all in family care partners who died before their loved one because they neglected their own health and the strain of what they were dealing with. And you know, agitation is not a little fidgetiness. I think neurologists understand that, and a lot of other people who haven't seen it up close don't. If we're just talking fidgetiness, get a fidget blanket. You'll probably be fine. But if what we're talking about is a loved one who is violent, because they are disoriented and scared, and you haven't been able to use any of the non-pharmacological means to reassure and calm them and make them understand that they are safe and that you are not a threat, well, you have to deal with that violence. And isn't it better to deal with it with an FDA-approved, safe and efficacious therapy properly managed by an appropriate physician than to just immediately resort to a nursing home placement or an assisted living placement where that individual is going to feel no safer, no more secure, and be alienated from the care environment of them so much? And oh, by the way, a tremendous expense and possible danger to themselves. So you haven't fixed anything, you've just relocated the problem. So if there's an option, FDA approved, on-label option to try to fix a problem that couldn't be fixed, well, I'll tell you, that's another breakthrough field, community, and it's not a cure, and it's not a solution for everyone. But, you know, just like the disease-modifying therapies, it's the dawn of a new age of opportunity that our community embraces while wanting more and better and sooner.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.